Today's EI Talks is recorded live at the Engelsberg Seminar 2023, a gathering of global authorities discussing the theme of leadership and statecraft. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and our guest, Times columnist James Marriott.
James, welcome to the podcast. First question, you gave a talk on AI and art. Do you think art matters in the age of AI?
Thank you very much for having me. Yes, I do. I guess I wanted to come at the issue. So much of the conversation around AI comes from computer scientists and people in Silicon Valley without much experience of art and literature. And I wanted to come at the problem of art in the age of AI from the perspective of a humanities graduate who I think our opinions are often not taken particularly seriously by Silicon Valley, and for good reason, because we're not the people to talk to about coding or engineering computers or things like that. But I do think the conversation around AI in Silicon Valley does miss that perspective, and a lot of the people having these conversations don't understand art and literature in a way that makes that conversation poorer, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's not ideal that much of the high-level discussion about what AI is, machine learning, whatever we call it, has actually taken place within businesses. So I can obviously see a scenario over the last decade where at Google, all the Google execs have come in every day and, you know, had a sort of their kind of daily seminar about what they think AI is, what they're producing, and all that. And I think it's much better for that debate to be lifted out of the boardroom and into the public sphere. But that also demands us to kind of almost rise to the challenge and start thinking in, I think, much clearer terms about what we mean by technology, artificial intelligence, art. I mean, from your perspective, what do you think art is, and is it reducible to a kind of, could it ever be reducible to a machine intelligence?
My ultimate answer is no, but I think it's important to qualify that by saying, first of all, that clearly what generative artificial intelligence is capable of now is unbelievably impressive. And, you know, I think there's a bit of a tendency among people like me who are, you know, horrified by the idea that a machine could make art to just start dismissing the fact that, you know, suddenly we have this program DALL-E, which, you know, can produce a picture of Greggs in the style of Van Gogh. Mm-hmm. And we sort of say, oh, well, you know, it's not really a Van Gogh. But if you told me that a year ago, 2 years ago, that a machine would be capable of writing a sonnet, as I said in my talk about pepperoni pizza in the style of William Shakespeare, out of my mind would have been blown. And I think we have to not forget what an astonishing and alarming advance that is. On the other hand, my thesis is that central to art is an irreducible human element, and that art is something that human beings do. And one of its most important aspects is communication between human beings. And any machine that creates art will fundamentally miss that element of it.
So do you think it's more likely that we get bored by the machines rather than that they will take over?
Potentially. There's an interesting statistic about ChatGPT is that the average user uses it 6 times and then stops and sort of gives up. I mean, that's obviously, you know, in 10 years' time, ChatGPT will seem, we have to assume, very primitive. I think it all comes down to this sort of slightly still difficult to quantify psychological aspect. There's a really interesting interview with Steven Pinker in the magazine, The Harvard Gazette, where he talks about these sort of deep, irrational intuitions human beings have about causal connections to other human beings. So he makes a very interesting analogy with the kind of millionaire American collector who might spend hundreds of thousands of pounds, dollars rather, buying, you know, JFK's golf clubs, even though they are functionally identical to the golf clubs of some other totally random American of that period. And this, for him, is the sort of an interesting insight into this really profound, completely irrational human response to other human beings and the things that connect us to them. And I think this is one of the kind of fundamental things about art, is that so many of our responses to art are tied up with the fact that another human being made it. I was having an interesting conversation with my dad recently. He'd been in an art gallery looking at a picture, and I was so struck by the way that he immediately was talking about this painting in terms of, you know, I can just imagine what the painter was doing. He spent his entire life following this subject. And I think our fascination with art is very psychological in a way that has been slightly unfashionable to admit in, you know, a lot of kind of art and literary criticism in the sort of 20th century has tried to say that, you know, an art object is this sort of thing that should be examined without context. The new critics who flourished in the sort of middle of the 20th century were obsessed with this idea that a poem, you know, they talked about the biographical fallacy. You shouldn't read biography into a poem. But this is, I think, essential to the way we actually respond to art. And I'm not convinced that a work of art without that human connection that doesn't trigger those deep irrational intuitions about human connection in us, I wonder how interesting that will ever be to anyone after a certain point.
And I guess if you don't bring your full humanness, almost to mix metaphors, to the table when you're looking at a piece of artwork or digesting a novel, you are sort of fundamentally impoverishing your own experience. You know, if you're reading a novel, especially like big capacious 19th century novels, which are full of digressions, full of historical ephemera, full of things which are stylistically almost at times quite out of joints with the rest of it. When you're reading it, you don't sit there sort of rationally making connections like a machine learning computer would do, which is to kind of infer possibilities from sort of networks of things. You bring your whole body, mind, these kind of mysterious things. And if you don't do that, it's kind of, you're sort of fundamentally missing the point. But take us to the world of chess and the relationship between robots playing chess and human beings.
I think it's such a fascinating analogy because the disruption happening with the AI right now seems like this new terrifying thing that we've never encountered before. But in fact, chess was disrupted by artificial intelligence in the 90s when the machine Deep Blue beat the world grandmaster Garry Kasparov at chess. And at the time, it's interesting, if you go back and look at a lot of the commentary around that match, people were sort of saying, well, chess is finished. It's been solved. The problem is over. Now that machines can do it, no human being will ever be as good as a machine at chess from now on. And therefore, who cares about chess? In fact, absolutely the opposite has happened. Chess is currently more popular now than it ever has been. I don't know if you ever have ventured onto chess.com, but I have, and I'm a great, although somewhat flawed, enthusiast of chess. It's enormous. Yeah. Millions and millions of people go onto YouTube and watch chess matches, millions of views. This is despite the fact that, I mean, chess computers now are incomprehensibly good. There are things, I mean, they're so good that there are things that human beings can learn from chess computers about how to improve their games. There's also a point at which a human can no longer learn from a chess computer because the sort of tactics now used by the most advanced chess computers, we don't even know what they're doing. Great chess minds can't work out the rationale behind the strategy of this god-level chess that's being played by computers. But, you know, go onto YouTube, how many people are watching chess matches between computers? Not very many people. Magnus Carlsen, who's the greatest human player ever to have lived, partly because he's learnt a lot of his chess skill from observing computers playing chess. Is he a household name among nerds? He's a household name. Probably the most famous chess player in his own time ever to have lived. Everybody, you know, very widely known, has like a clothing line. He makes millions. He's, you know, all these bizarre things you would never expect for a chess player. I think he was modeling recently.
Yeah, and there's an air of scandal with him, isn't there?
But nobody knows, you know, the machines that play chess, Stockfish, AlphaZero, people, these aren't household names in the same way. And I think what this kind of shows is that we would have believed, you know, before AI came along, that what we appreciated in chess was this kind of battle of pure intellect, the sort of mathematical, logical skill that went into a game of chess. It turns out actually that our interest in chess is so much more actually to do with the human personalities behind it. And Magnus Carlsen, genius that he is a vastly inferior player to a computer. And yet he is vastly more interesting to human chess fans than a computer.
And that comes to the idea, James, of morality. One of the really important questions that's raised about art at the moment is, can great art made by really bad people be acceptable? Should we censor, in a way? Should we cancel art? We think of people like Picasso, his relationship with women, his misogyny. Wagner, of course, is the classic case of the bad person, a raging, unapologetic anti-Semite, and as well as many other personal flaws, and yet they produce great art. And part of the fascination with art is, as you say, with the person who produces it because of the moral questions that surround it.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think you're right to say, especially now, we're more preoccupied with the identity and the personal failings and, you know, race or gender background of the person who produced a work of art. And it's sort of that obsession, I think, as you say, tells us a lot about what's interesting about a work of art and how we judge a work of art. And, you know, I think we might say that it's gone too far and we talk too much about the personalities behind art. But that conversation is still a clue to what is interesting in art to us, which is, yes, partly the art, also the artist, the person who produced it. How do you have a conversation about the morality of a machine behind a work of art? Unless, you know, AI does murder all, you know, does start murdering humans. And then we may think that we shouldn't be appreciating poems made by a machine that's also attempting to destroy the human race.
But it also, even if you look at the history of computing and the history of human beings' attempts to theorize thinking machines, most famously Alan Turing, who basically sets the intellectual framework in which modern artificial intelligence works. Computer scientists for decades have attempted to create a machine which passes a Turing test, which, if you know about the Turing test, it wouldn't summarize precisely what it is, but it's rooted in an Edwardian parlor game. You know, it's this, it's like a trick, but it sets a clear goal for computer scientists. And I think scientists love that idea that you've got a clear goal in the future, and through a level of kind of ingenuity and hard work, you can eventually synthesize something which matches it. But as we know, intellectual history often doesn't work like that. It operates in leaps and bounds and diversions.
And ambiguities.
And, exactly.
Well,
and genuine creativity, you know, isn't actually set up in ways that computer science often accepts. And I think Turing is a great example. He was obsessed with chess. He thought that basically the most intelligent thing human beings could do, because one of his best friends at Bletchley Park was a champion chess player. And he was sort of obsessed with this kind of intelligence. But as we know, the ability to play chess is, you know, 0.1% of what it means to be human.
It was the first
what
thing,
it means to be intelligent.
It was the first thing, it was the first thing to be conquered. You know, the first high-profile bar to be conquered by artificial intelligence. I agree with that. I also think we should be cautious. My argument is only from the perspective of human psychology. I'm very cautious about saying that there are limits to what AI can do, because I think this is a place where, again, you know, our human intuitions may fail, and we know that these large language models work by probabilistically choosing the next word in a sentence, the next word, and the next word, and filling in gaps that way. To us, that doesn't sound like intelligence, because that's not how our intelligence works. But it's very possible that we simply lack the imagination to understand when you have, you know, trillions of parameters and trillions and trillions and trillions of words and texts, what human-like intelligence can be produced from those very inhuman processes. So I think I'm cautious about, you know, ever saying that I believe there are limits to what artificial intelligence can achieve, although it does seem at the moment that large language models have some sort of quite fundamental flaws in the way they work. What I think is fascinating is I can't now read a book without thinking, how could a machine do this? Mm. And I think a lot about this, a lot of the ways that novels are written in the middle of the 20th century, the middle and latter half of the 20th century, especially in America, there was this real cult, people like Nabokov, Updike. In Britain, we had Martin Amis. There was a real cult of one of the great things a novelist did was sort of show you the world afresh. You know, Nabokov would look at a railing or wallpaper, and his original human observation, nobody, we believed, had ever noticed this thing about a wallpaper. There's a great passage in Speak Memory about him looking at the wallpaper in his room as a kid growing up in Russia. And the freshness of that observation was one of the things that we believed was fundamental to art, and was one of the highest things a novelist could achieve. And you sort of think, could a machine ever do that? Could a machine ever have that perception about wallpaper? Our human intuition is no. In fact, could a machine with access to every human text ever written reconstruct that observation? Potentially, yes. And it's sort of, I think that could be a challenge to our ideas of what can be achieved through a machine that has a profoundly unhuman intelligence operating on kind of these vast bodies of text. And I'm always sort of looking out now for things that seem human about works of art. There's a really lovely little detail in another Nabokov book, Pnin, where Nabokov describes how Pnin has this sort of horrible, mangled, very Russian teeth that, you know, desperately need to be fixed. And he talks about how he has this sort of jagged tooth at the back of his mouth, which is like a kind of broken rock. And there are bits of food always being stuck in it. And Nabokov says like sort of seaweed stuck on a rock and sort of drifting around the back of your mouth. And you're always trying to, you know, get that bit of food out. And it's a beautiful image. Is that something a machine could ever know? A machine doesn't have a mouth. And is that the sort of extra 1 or 2% of genius in novels that can't be produced by machines? Or could a machine with access to all of dental literature, all of novels, everything everyone has ever written about having a mouth, could it reproduce that? I don't know.
And that focus in is very much on flaws, on foibles, on imperfections. And often what creates great art, or what is part of the process of great art, or indeed many human achievements, is imperfection, a focus on imperfection, and often on misunderstanding, a kind of creative misunderstanding of serendipity. And I wonder whether that could ever be created in an AI kind of way.
Yeah.
Because it's essentially a process of perfection, of perfectibility. Whereas part of what is wonderful about art is the imperfectibility of it. It's almost like an original sin in a
way. Yeah. I wish I agreed. I think if the purpose of building an artificial intelligence is to recreate what appears to us to be human intelligence, a machine that could do that well would recreate human flaws, human imperfections. I mean, these things are working from texts produced by humans. They're learning, you know, human flaws as well as human perfection. I think, again, coming back to that psychological thing, the interesting thing with that point is the way that humans experience art. And if we know there's a human intention behind a work of art, you know, if I'm given a difficult poem by T.S. Eliot or Auden, I'll spend, you know, an afternoon reading it and niggling away at the meaning because I psychologically intuit that a human being has meant something by this complex poem. And the things that may appear to be flaws or difficulties, I'll want to needle through and work my way through to work out what the intention was. A poem produced by a machine that resembles a poem by T.S. Eliot, I would lack that confidence that there was meaning to find out because the machine may have just produced a thing that superficially looked like it was indicating towards obscure meanings, but was a machine can't have intention. Therefore, that sort of destroys half the experience of reading a poem, or half the experience of reading a difficult modernist poem, for instance, which is trying to work out what the poet is trying to say or what you believe he's trying to say. That aspect, I think, can't be recreated by machines.
But the idea that you just put, Paul, it's expressed actually very well in Thomas Mann's novel Felix Krull, in that Felix Krull talks about, he's saying, this is a truthful memoir of my life and my experience, and take it on trust that I am really speaking the truth. I'm not tricking you. But it's a novel, so we're coming at it from, you're immediately skeptical about the claims he's making, but you kind of take it on trust. And there's this bit where he talks about how words are just this closed loop. They don't, for some human experiences, they don't express anything about them. They might as well be a completely self-referential circle. And then he talks about how the language he really understands, it's either the glance or the embrace. And these are the two most transcendental aspects of what it means to encounter another human being. But to get to that point where he makes that claim, and he also then says, yes, but of course I'm having to express this through words. It's imperfect. But that dance of imperfection and words and hinting towards what it means to be a human being in that place, in that moment, encountering another human being, to get to that point to express it, you need to make all kinds of caveats about the imperfections of our own ability to communicate. And I think if we had a kind of artificial intelligence, part of intelligence is the flaw and the mishap. And what it may replicate, which would kind of be an awesome and beautiful idea, would replicate our own faulty misunderstandings about what constitutes intelligence to ourselves.
And I think
it would
also
be that work in progress.
And I think also historically, all the paths to horror and tyranny that humans have done have been ideas that are the pursuit of perfection. The pursuit of perfection seems to me to be the most assured path to misery and suffering and horror. And maybe, it may be that AI is just one more of these projects of perfection.
Yeah, but a very human thing is to pursue imperfection in other people.
To enjoy.
To be, as it's to talking, James, this interest in this chess player, is his name, Carlsen, you know, people are interested in him because he acts strangely. He appears to be drunk when he plays at points, I think.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think I'm a little more skeptical than you are. And I think human imperfections reasonably could be replicated by a machine. I think the point about human psychology is a little more kind of abstract. It's simply that the knowledge that it's a human being, our knowledge that our theory of mind about our interactions with another human mind, I think that is the kind of crucial point. And a machine that perfectly replicated, human frailties and flaws and faults would be less interesting simply because that theory of mind that we carry into every human interaction would fail, and we would not perceive an intention, and we would not perceive a personality, and we would not perceive that the machine we were talking to had a consciousness like us. There's one caveat I want to make, which is that I don't think machines will not write any books or will not write any popular books. I think there are certainly parts of literature that will be automated. And what we're talking about is a line about, the line of where humanness matters. And I think nobody quite knows yet where that line is going to fall. I was talking to someone in publishing. They're already talking about the automation of romance novelists. You know, things like Mills and Boone, where these books are mass-produced, sometimes by multiple people working on the same book, almost always under pseudonyms. How much is anybody reading those for the human personality behind it, and how much are people sort of reading quite mechanistically and going through the plots are very similar. They're very formulaic. People who write these novels learn a series of formulas to perform them. They sort of, there are some human authors who almost turn themselves into machines in order to be prolific. That may be automatable, but there's still part of me that thinks, will human beings read a novel about love? The most human thing about us. Will we accept even the trashiest novel about love to be by a machine? Part of me finds it hard to get my head around that, but
we might.
I could be wrong. That's true. Although I think this point was made yesterday in my talk, and I think we have to accept that we will know, because a world in which there is no legislation saying if this is by a machine, you must say it's by a machine, and a world without various sort of checks that can be made about that, I mean, that is a profoundly chaotic world. And I think we have to make sure that we will always know whether we're reading a human text or an AI text.
Yeah, and copyright and
everything. Yeah, the difficulty, of course, will be when texts are sort of collaborative and there are already machines for, writing novels. Studio released this software recently where you sort of put in a prompt for what you want to happen in this chapter and it sort of unfolds. Then you put in the next prompt and it unfolds. And it's that sort of, who's writing that novel? Is it the machine? Is it the human being? There is human intention there because the human is prompting the machine along the way.
It's a little like Carlsen with learning from the machine.
Yes, although I guess Carlsen is never totally, he's never collaborating on a game of chess with a machine. An interesting thing will be what might we learn about writing and art from what machines are doing. Chess has really changed thanks to AI. People play chess very differently after computers compared to before computers. There's some fascinating games on YouTube you can watch where AlphaZero will play chess in this totally weird way where it just sort of like creeps its pawns up the board like a kind of horrible octopus. And the human player is just sort of, all the pieces are suddenly trapped by this sort of weird formation of pawns that nobody has ever created before, because it's beyond human intelligence to conceive that this sort of apparently logical way of playing chess might be an effective way. And we may learn things about language, and the best human artists may become better.
But we've already gone through a process like that in my own lifetime, from writing stuff out, the novel written in longhand, to one almost always now ubiquitously written on a computer or some kind of device. And I've noticed that it has changed the way I write, because writing now is not so much a continuous process. It's one of
process of editing in a way, that you put stuff down, you then edit, because it's so much easier to shift things around on a computer screen than it is to write longhand. That has hugely affected, yeah, I think, the way in which novels or indeed nonfiction is written. I mean, I've noticed it in my own work over, say, the last 30 years. I write differently now to when I did 30 years ago.
But does it not almost add to the... I totally get that anxious feeling when you're in a Word document and you feel like the writing has become mashed up into a kind of internal editorial process and you're sort of just scanning it up and up and down. But part of the great joy of writing is feeling those shackles release somewhat and suddenly feeling like the structure of the piece has suddenly appeared in your head as if it was already there. And then you can just write more fluently. So I wonder whether that is also just points towards the fact that it may impose certain restrictions on thought, but we also react very strongly against that. We are constantly sort of struggling, and that's a very human thing.
Well, every new innovation offers positive aspects and negative aspects.
But just to come back to chess, I'm just reminded of talking about the possibilities within the chessboard and how a machine can do these almost sort of what look to us irrational moves. Music is another thing where initially you think the 12-tone scale, for example. There must be a set, there must be a limit on the number of possibilities that the 12-tone scale gives to musicians. But as we know, with the way in which compound numbers work, 12 tones actually equals gazillions of possible combinations, harmonies. You know, I think it's kind of literally unthinkable the number of possibilities that even the 12-tone Western scale gives to music. And that's before we get into, you know, other traditions like Hindu, there's more varied tonality. But the point is, music, unlike chess, I think when there have been attempts for machines to create music in certain styles or to generate music, it's fantastically bad to the point where it would be probably completely uncommercial. And I've not seen any good example of AI-generated music. But there is so much great music about the idea that uses innovations in technology that are rooted in powerful machines.
But this is an interesting point, I think, because there are three activities in which the prodigy emerges. Mathematics, that's one. Chess is another, where you can have that prodigy with almost no life experience at all. Brilliant at mathematics, brilliant at chess. The other one is music, where you have the prodigy at music, no life experience. There are no 6-year-old novelists or 10-year-old novelists or 12-year-old novelists. This is something that is sieved through life experience. And you know, that seems to me a big difference. It's already the case that AI is mastering those things like music. It's certainly mastered chess.
Yeah.
And mathematics is obviously a key part of it. The next stage will be that stuff in which life experience matters, such as the novel.
Yeah. I'm not sure I necessarily agree with you about AI music. I think there's a really alarming clip of some DJ, might it be David Guetta, playing what he says is a new Eminem track to a vast crowd at a rave. And he presses it and the track comes on, the crowd goes absolutely mental and they love it. Mm-hmm. And the words are written by artificial intelligence. The music was written by artificial intelligence. The Eminem's voice is artificial intelligence. And, you know, he said that was a very creepy moment. You can go onto YouTube and watch videos of romantic symphonies produced by AI that aren't, you know, they're not Beethoven, but they're not obviously awful. People think things like, you know...
But they're not new.
They're not new.
And that's what is interesting. You know, we don't just listen to... We also listen to every performance because it's a new...
That's true. And the point about the music that's on YouTube is actually nobody's really seeking it out. You know, AI can produce pretty competent music, but nobody who's interested in music really is going to look for it. And that might be that sort of human intuition.
Because music is that kind of bridge, isn't it? In the sense that mathematics and chess are these contained experiences. Yes. Whereas music, you have the prodigy, but actually the composition, the real stuff that transcends human experience and everything else is actually written by people who are mature, who have that combination of the musical brilliance, whatever that constitutes, plus that life experience. You know, Beethoven is that kind of genius. Mozart is the classic child prodigy, but something like The Marriage of Figaro, Così fan tutti, is based upon the idea of a lived experience and a profound kind of
again, I'm just always a little more skeptical than you, because I think perhaps our human intuitions fail when we try to imagine what could be constructed out of, you know, billions of parameters of ways of parsing billions and billions of data sets about text and music. And because we have a human intelligence, we think there's only one way to arrive at music. We may be utterly confounded that a thing that appears profoundly non-human with immense processing power can actually recreate something that seems frighteningly human. Whether I always just think that crucial question is a psychological one. Will people care? Will people care about a chess game between computers? Will people care about music produced by AI? The answer so far seems to be that's sort of not interesting. We're obsessed with human personality.
But I just wonder with music, because it's a combination of form and sort of formlessness, like music's obviously physical, it goes into your ear and then it hits those parts of the brain which are, you know, close to the emotional kind of cortex.
Particularly the human voice.
Exactly.
That's profoundly different.
But that kind of physicality of music, you know, it certainly, you can see a situation where, of course, a machine would be able to process the entire history of music, but the production of new music is not necessarily about processing power. It's about a weird interaction between formlessness, form, and emotion.
And I think this is
what actually where classical music has an advantage over pop or rock music, in that it's unmediated, in the sense that if you actually see it, there's no amplification, there's nothing that's mediated there. It's immensely physical, particularly when the human voice is there. It's a very, very physical act, in the way that it's no surprise to me at all that you can make what sounds like a legitimate, say, dance music track, because actually Kraftwerk have been doing that for about 40 years. So there's nothing, much longer than 40 years, best part of half a century that's been being done. That electronic stuff, that sampled thing, the whole idea of the sampler is part of that. The technology, if you listen to the soundscapes of something like Public Enemy, like Hank Shockley, people like that, they were doing this a very long time ago. And so I think it's much easier for pop stroke rock music to be replicated than, say, classical music.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think there's a really important analogy between classical music specifically and chess, which is that classical music, the fascination of classical music for people who really like it is what can human beings achieve. So the fascination of chess is what can a human mind achieve on the chessboard? That's what's interesting. The fascination of classical music is how good can the human voice be? How virtuosic can a human violinist be? Also, I think important for classical music, which is something that's hard to imagine computers recreating, is that classical music, we always listening to it have a sense of where it belongs in history. We understand that in the 19th century, people wrote music in a certain way. The 18th century, people wrote music in a certain way. I've been listening to quite a bit of Handel recently, and every time I listen to it, I'm just sort of so struck by, I don't know, for me, Handel conjures an emotional world that is the emotional world of the 18th century. So much of it, listening to his opera Giulio Cesare, I was thinking, this is such undemocratic music. It's so much about power and stateliness and grandeur. And these are just not themes of 20th or 21st century music, because those are things that we're much more skeptical of. And our music is, you know, much more, I think, the music of individualism and freedom. And an AI is not embedded in historical context in that way. And that fascination of an artwork is abolished, because an AI would be necessarily ahistorical. And another point about classical music that someone else made to me recently was, do we really believe that anything could be better than Mozart or Bach? And because of the internet, Mozart and Bach are not, you know, anyone can have the best music ever produced by humans all the time, whenever. When you have that at your fingertips, is the best music produced by machines interesting? You know, if we couldn't listen to Mozart and Bach whenever you wanted on YouTube, perhaps machine-produced music might be more interesting. But you don't need a machine to produce music, because we have constant access to the greatest human music ever. And that, you know, that changes things, I think.
I think the same is true sort of the history of philosophy, which, you know, philosophy doesn't actually, it doesn't have a direction in the way that we often impose on novels, for example. You know, we talk about the history of the novel starting off and then developing in complexity and self-reference. But philosophy sort of goes round and round and round. And the questions which Plato, right at the beginning, is posing about the nature of the good, the true and the beautiful, we haven't necessarily come up with better answers to those questions. We have just, it just continued. And I think the, for example, a machine to create better answers to the questions posed by Plato that have not been answered in the whole history of philosophy, we would have to create someone who, by some margin, had a greater genius than Plato himself, because some of these questions that he's addressing are not sort of reducible to the amount of processing power, the amount of neural nets we can sort of direct at it, because for whatever reason, it's just not, it doesn't fit, you know.
Yeah, and I think it also hits an important thing is, you know, I think it's maybe a slight aspect of human narcissism for us to even believe that we're that interested in intelligence. You know, I don't think...
Yes.
It may turn out that a lot of the fascination, the history of philosophy, is not a fascination with intelligence. It's a fascination with human personalities. And I was saying in my talk earlier, you know, the fascination of the radio phone-in show, people who are often not very well informed about current affairs phone into the radio with their very terrible views on, you know, aspects of current affairs. We're fascinated by it, not because we think these programs are going to teach us anything about the answer to immigration or Brexit. The people talking about these issues are often not very well informed, but because they're human opinions, and the history of philosophy may turn out to actually be the history of human opinions rather than the history of the purest, most advanced intelligence. That may not be what we're actually that interested in.
And so to conclude, James, after this fascinating discussion, we'll be left with, once the machines have taken over, we'll be left with classical philosophy, classical music, and the talking chat show. 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
What a strange future that will be.
Yeah, but as I say, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. So thank you, James. That was brilliant.
Thanks very much for having me.
Discussion on art and AI. Thank you very much.